Good evening, everyone, or good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. My name is Simon Lester. I am the Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policies, Trade Policy at the Cato Institute. With me today is a great set of panelists. We have Henry Gao, an Associate Professor of Law at Singapore Management University. We have Neha Mishra, a lecturer at Australian National University College of Law. And we have David Weller, Director of Economic and Trade Policy at Google. Thanks to all of them for making the time to be here. Turning to our topic for today's event, national debates over policies that affect the flow of data have been heating up as censorship, surveillance, control over personal data, and requirements to store data locally have emerged as contentious political issues in many, if not all, countries. And at the same time, governments are negotiating international agreements that constrain their ability to regulate domestically in this area. What we're going to be talking about for the next hour is the relationship between these two things and asking the following question: can international rules improve domestic regulation of digital trade? My goal in setting up this event was to appeal to two sets of audiences. The first set is people who know very little about the topic and are just trying to get up to speed. And I myself still fall into this category to some extent. I feel like I'm playing catch up because I know there are a lot of smart people like our panelists who have been thinking about this topic for years. So for this audience, we'll go over the basics. What are people talking about when they talk about digital barriers to trade? What are some examples? What could international agreements do about any of this? And then the second set is people who already know a lot about this and want to hear some of the nuances. How specifically can international agreements help here? What should the international agreements say? How should governance work? So let's dive into all of that now. The way we're going to proceed is that each speaker will go for about 5 to 7 minutes, and then I'll ask a series of questions to get us into the nuances of the issue. While I'm doing that, the audience should feel free to submit their own questions, and I'll either try to work them into mine or just ask those questions separately. So you can submit these via the event webpage or Facebook or Twitter or YouTube with the hashtag CatoTrade. So we're going to start off with David, who will talk about the main ways that governments are regulating or not regulating that are causing problems for businesses or consumers. And then Neha will give an overview of how international agreements address problems with domestic regulation or non-regulation in the area of digital policy. And then finally, Henry will tell us about the different perspectives of China and the US and potential convergence between the two in some areas. So let's go now to David to kick things off. Over to you, David.
Great. Thanks, Simon. And thanks to the Cato team for having me. This is such an important and challenging conversation. I'm glad we have two esteemed academics on the panel as well, because they really are tricky issues. But before turning to your specific question on sort of the types of regulation that we're seeing in the digital space and kind of their trade effects, I wanted to take a step back and just say a word about the stakes and really what the internet means for trade. And I think, you know, you talked about kind of different audiences for your conversation, and sort of for a non-trade technology audience, I think they know quite instinctively about the nature of the internet as an open network of networks that was designed fundamentally to promote openness and interoperability and really maximized interconnection, and is by design really a global commons. And, you know, it doesn't take long to think about that in a trade context and appreciate kind of the power of that kind of technology and technology model for trade. And this is already a well-known story in terms of how the internet is flattening trade, expanding who participates in trade. And I hate to say this sometimes because it feels, you know, very grand and highfalutin, but I really think democratizing trade. And that's by now a pretty well-known story. It is worth pausing for a moment, though, and thinking about sort of in the COVID context of the past year, what that has meant. And I just wanted to kind of flag a couple of statistics that bring it home to light. The first is that in the United States, one in three U.S. small businesses report over the past year that digital tools have kept them open, essentially. And some portion of those, some decent portion of those point to the expanded customer base and markets that they've been able to reach in a time of COVID. So as, you know, demand dropped because of different restrictions and obviously no one coming into stores, but even, you know, even different economic impacts across geographies, small businesses really being able to expand their base. And 40% of small businesses say they're using digital tools, have been using digital tools to find new customers during COVID, including internationally. And that's just such a, you think about the hardship of the past year plus, that's such a powerful and important story. You know, just as in to get more directly to your question, Simon, of sort of the kinds of regulation that we're seeing and how it's impeding at times some of this model, I think it's first just worth noting, of course, regulation, like for any technology, is critical. Ultimately, it's actually technology will not get properly implemented and harvested and taken up without proper regulation. And indeed, in the era of the internet, despite sort of conventional wisdom, it has not been an unregulated space for the past 20 years. There's new regulation that needs to be developed, but there's lots of regulation in the internet space. But I just want to note that I don't think this is a conversation about how does regulation per se interfere with trade. That being said, and as your setup kind of alluded to, the way regulation is pursued really can undermine some of the trade benefits and potential that I just spoke about that we see from digital technologies and from the internet. And so it's, you know, a bit of a story of, you know, you giveth with one hand and taketh away with another, and you know, trade policy can play a critical role in putting some parameters around that. And I just wanted to highlight kind of three areas of the kind of regulation that we're seeing that I think has, you know, trade has something to say about, or regulatory trends. The first is really discrimination in closed markets, tilting the playing field in favor of local players and closing markets to foreign providers. You know, this is nothing new, and this is sort of normal political economy and national politics. We're just seeing it now play out in a different form factor in the case of digital. The second is really lack of transparency and due process. And I think you often see this in the area of sort of new technologies, and often technologies that touch, you know, critical social and other political matters, often of great political sensitivity in governments, not imposing kind of good rule of law approaches to regulation of a new technology. Again, this for any sort of trade lawyer, trade policy person, transparency, due process is kind of a very common norm. But again, sort of thinking about that in the trade context, the digital trade context. And then the third point I'd highlight and trend that we're really seeing is a lack of interoperability and really governments making digital policies in a vacuum. I think we are in a bit of a, you know, I don't know what the right adjective to describe our current state of affairs, but there is a active debate in almost every major and minor geography in the world about new regulation around digital issues, around online speech, around online markets, many, many privacy, many, many different issues. And a lot of those are needed and good conversations, but we're seeing much too much of governments taking on those issues and addressing those issues in silos. And when they don't think about how one country's sets of rules dealing with a common issue differ from another country's, then you end up in a real mishmash, which sort of just as much as discrimination can really take away the benefits that the technologies offer. So those are, I think, three broad trends that we see in the regulatory space that I think threaten some of the digital trade benefits, and that I think trade policy can help address.
That's a great background on the importance of digital trade, some of the barriers, the hurdles that have come up, and also a very nice segue, I think, into what Neha will be talking about. So when we talk about the lack of interoperability between different, you know, countries' regimes, well, you know, you might think, well, international agreements could help with that. So let's turn now to Neha to talk about how they have or might.
Thank you so much, Simon, and a big thank you to Cato and Simon for inviting me to this fantastic webinar. So David provided a very good overview of the internet and digital technologies as a tool for digital trade, and as well as the interface of domestic regulation and digital trade in the real world. And I completely agree with him that in a short span of time and in a rather dramatic manner, we are seeing different countries at different levels of digital advancement imposing a variety of new kinds of regulations in the digital sector. And if you think of the changes, they have been so swift, because from practically little to no regulation several years ago, maybe about 15, 20 years ago in many countries, not all, we now are living in an era where we have heavy-handed regulation in most parts of the world, if not everywhere. So this intersection of domestic digital policies and digital trade, whether it's in areas such as data protection, cybersecurity, censorship, intellectual property, competition—I mean, the whole range of areas—is definitely a challenge. And as David said, the diversity of regulatory approaches, coupled with the differences in regulation, at least at a granular level, is often a challenge for trade policymakers alongside businesses as well. But on the positive side, I do think there is now some movement towards a common high-level approach in some areas of digital regulation, at least among like-minded countries. Now, when it comes to international trade agreements and digital policies, my view generally has been that international trade agreements do not necessarily stifle digital regulation. So I think of some of the mainstream views are that, you know, these are very harmful for digital regulation. That's not always the case. But of course, I should add some qualifications here, one of which is that domestic digital regulations may be subject to principles, fundamental principles in international trade agreements, non-discrimination, transparency, certain obligations on perhaps on market access might be applicable, or there could be domestic regulations on services that might apply, although those disciplines are not as well developed in the WTO law context. And the other aspect that we should keep in mind is, especially at the WTO and many FTAs, countries make sector-specific commitments on market access and national treatment. So the coverage of trade agreements, international trade agreements with respect to digital services and digital technologies can really vary from country to country. Of course, another important aspect that would jump out when you think of the intersection of domestic policies and trade law are the exceptions in international trade agreement. And the question that often arises, given all these technologies developing and how digital trade is evolving, is whether these exceptions, even with the exceptions contained in more recent free trade agreements, whether they are relevant and they are suitable to the policy problems that governments face in the digital world. Now, it's good to, of course, note that there are a wide variety of exceptions. Now, if you compare, for instance, the WTO treaties to the CPTPP style of exceptions, and now more recently to the RCEP, you see a whole range of ways in which governments or trading partners are coming together and drafting exceptions. And that has significant implications for regulatory autonomy as well. But at the same time, I mean, if you just look at the old school WTO exceptions, I think we can argue that they would normally, at least they can be contextually applied to the digital sector in what is known as evolutionary interpretation within the WTO law context, and also in line with what, again, a lot of trade lawyers call the principle of technological neutrality. So I think if, say, a dispute were to arise today, say, on a hard data localization measure in a country, and presuming an obligation has been breached, it is still quite likely that a WTO panel would take a more deferential stance as far as the regulatory objectives are concerned, but they might be more stringent when it comes to, say, applying the weighing and balancing test if they are looking at a general exception or if they are looking at the conditions for the security exception. In some of my work, what I have argued is that even if you were to apply some of these exceptions from a purely techno-legal perspective without getting into some of the policy challenges involved, trade tribunals are still likely to face difficult questions. And one of the reasons, and I think David identified both of the reasons, one is that there's lack of consensus among countries on what the norms are, and also the fact that even within the internet and technical and policy community, there is an ongoing debate on what the best tools are. Should it be only regulations, or can it be a combination of regulations and technological approaches? These are unsolved debates. And in that environment of technology and policy uncertainty, it's difficult for trade agreements to determine the extent to which trade agreements should regulate digital policy. Now, on the point of non-regulation in the digital domain and what WTO law, for instance, can do about it, I would say there isn't that much, because WTO law does not set standards or does not prescribe frameworks for privacy or online consumer protection or cyber crimes. And that should be the case as well, because it's not a standard setting body, it's a trade organization. But we see a perceptible change in FTAs. So for instance, there are quite a few FTAs, e-commerce chapters and FTAs that contain provisions on privacy or online consumer protection, where countries have come together and agreed to adopt a common standard, especially where they are like-minded countries. They identify specific standards such as the OECD guidelines or the APEC framework or the UNCITRAL model laws. And the other perceptible shift is looking at new areas like AI or open government data and some of the new digital economy agreements, which would have traditionally never been considered trade issues. And while there can be many positive developments coming out of it, I think it's an area where trade negotiators should also tread with a little bit of caution because it's untested yet. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Neha. That's a great introduction to the international component of all this. And let's carry that forward a little bit by going to Henry to talk about the U.S.-China relationship, which is just obviously dominating the trade debate in general, but here in digital trade is also important. So Henry, why don't you say a few words about that.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Cato, for inviting me to this really interesting discussion on digital trade issues. Now, in a paper that I published in 2018 in the Journal of International Economic Law, I argue that when you look at digital trade, the US actually focuses on digital aspects, while China focuses on the trade aspects. And now, I'm going to expand the horizon a little bit to also include the EU in this discussion as well, because the EU, with the introduction of the GDPR and other digital trade initiatives, have rapidly become a major player on this issue. So if you look at the different models, the three different models, these three different jurisdictions are kind of adopting, I would argue that they each focus on different aspects of the link in digital trade. I mean, if you look at digital trade, they are basically, they started out as a kind of a bilateral interaction between the firm and the individual, the consumer. So the firm provides you with the service and the individual are the consumers, but at the same time, they are also the production force in that they provide the data that the firms will use. And then the government comes into play as a regulator, as someone to arbitrate between the firm on the one hand and the individual on the other hand. So if you look at the approaches of these three different jurisdictions, I would call them three different so-called sovereignty models. For the US, I would call it a firm sovereignty model, because the US approach is basically to let the business firms take charge. So the firms decide everything and the government ready intervene. And for China, the model is more like the state sovereignty model, because the state has a lot of concerns regarding this so-called cybersecurity, or what the Chinese would even call cyber sovereignty. And there's a lot of restrictions on not only the firm, but also even on the individuals as to what you can do on the internet. And then finally, for the EU, what you have is what I would call an individual sovereignty model, because for the EU, the most important thing is privacy protection, where the focus on the protection of personal information on behalf of the consumer. And that is where the EU is coming in to use its regulatory power to try to claim a kind of a position in global digital trade regulation. So why do we have these three different approaches? I don't think these approaches are randomly chosen. Instead, I would argue that they reflect deeper differences in their respective commercial interests and also regulatory approaches within each jurisdiction. So first of all, if you look at the global digital trade marketplace, you could see that it is largely dominated by American and Chinese firms. Among the 10 biggest digital trade firms in the world, 6 are American firms and 4 are Chinese firms. Of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that they must share the same position. To the contrary, if you look closer, you can see that the US firms on the list tend to be pure digital service firms. Firms like Facebook, Google, and so on, they do not sell physical products, but they only provide digitized services, such as online search, social network, or content services. So for them, the digital side of things is more important. In contrast, if you look at the Chinese firms on the list, two of the largest ones are Alibaba and JD.com. They basically still sell physical goods. So when you have firms focus on digital services, no wonder that they would focus on the digital side, while for the Chinese, because they still sell traditional physical goods, they would focus on the traditional trade side when it comes to digital trade. So that is what you see, for example, in the submissions by the US and China in the WTO joint statement initiative negotiation on e-commerce, where the US tend to focus on issues such as free flow of data and a prohibition on data localization requirements, while the Chinese submission has mainly focused on the, for example, trade facilitation issues on digital trade. So that is a totally different focus. So some people might argue that China still has giant peer digital firms like Baidu and Tencent. Baidu was known as kind of the Google of China, and Tencent is known as the Facebook of China. If you look again, if you look closer at these two firms, I would argue that they are quite different from Google and Facebook, because they serve predominantly the domestic Chinese market, and most of their facilities and operations are based entirely in China. So they do not really share the demands of truly global firms like Google and Facebook, where they operate from every corner of the world. So of course, they would want to demand to have a free flow of data, like what you see in the US submissions. For the EU is not a major player in the business sense, because there's no leading EU firms in the e-commerce or digital service, digital trade market. So you could argue that the restrictive privacy rules and the GDPR is a form of digital protectionism, so that they can fend off the invasions of the American and Chinese firms into Europe and in the rest of the world as well. The second difference among these three jurisdictions is their different domestic regulatory approaches. In the US, if you look at the history of the internet regulation in the US, the US has long held the position that we need to provide some scholars like Chandler would call the permissive legal framework. which aims to minimize government regulation or control on the internet and relies heavily on self-regulation in the sector. Such policy is even codified in the law. For example, if you look at the Telecom Act of 1996, it says that the policy of the US is to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services unfettered by federal or state regulation. You know, I think somebody from Cato must have drafted this regulation because it sounds very Cato-like. So it's no surprise that the US would push for deregulation and a free flow of information at the international level. And this is this has been a longstanding policy because if you look at the history of discussion in the WTO, for example, the first time the WTO started to discuss e-commerce issues that was pushed by the Clinton administration back in 1997 when they launched the Global Economic Commerce Initiative. That is the position for the US. On the other hand, for China, the internet has always been subject to heavy government regulation. So I have another paper that is coming up next month. And in this paper, I trace the evolution of the Chinese internet regulation. And I argue that Chinese regulation has evolved from regulation of the hardware when the internet first appeared in China in 1994 to the regulation of content and now the regulation of data. So the whole regulatory approach is has been quite restrictive for a long time. And this is basically kept over in the digital age. For the EU, in contrast, they have a long tradition of human rights protection, and this is partly in response to the atrocities of the Second World War. So they realize that human rights is very important, and privacy, if you look at the GDPR, has been elevated into a human right, a fundamental human right under the GDPR, not just regarded as, for example, in the US, as a purely consumer right. So the EU approach is also very interesting in that it regulates privacy as a fundamental human right, and that will have major implications around the world. But even though these three different jurisdictions have all these different approaches, I do not think, as some people might have argued, that it is impossible for them to agree on a global deal, because at the end of the day, you might find them to agree to some lowest common denominator. And we already see that emerging. For example, you see that the US increasingly resort to security exceptions. For example, the recent restrictions on WeChat and TikTok. And China, on the other hand, China also started to agree to provisions on free flow of data and prohibition on data localization requirements, as you can see, to China's commitments in the e-commerce chapter of the recently concluded RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement. I'm a bit optimistic in seeing that a fruitful conclusion can be done in the WTO or another global forum, if not the WTO. But of course, I would hope for the WTO, which I will be happy to discuss later. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much, Henry. That was great. Great that you also brought the EU in there. So what we're going to do now is turn to a series of questions, and I have some prepared. I also see some coming in from viewers, from the audience out there. I know it's in the US, it's on the East Coast, it's late at night. So, you know, if you're too tired, that's okay. But if you've got the energy, throw in some questions. I'll try to get to them. I'm sure we won't get to all of them. I'll dive right in now. So my first question, and this is kind of a big picture question on international governance and international negotiations. So my question, it's maybe a series of questions. How will the various digital trade agreements be implemented and enforced? So there are a number of options here. You have litigation, you have discussion and oversight through committees, you have behind the scenes political pressure, you have soft law principles filtering down into domestic law. Are different options appropriate for different types of obligations? What's your view on how international governance will or should work under these agreements? And I'll turn first to Neha to answer that question.
Thanks, Simon. So I think in the long run, A variety of tools will be used, I think, to implement international trade agreements, whether it's dispute resolution methods. I think even some investment arbitration in the coming years could be relevant to the digital sector. But having said that, I don't know if it would be desirable to have digital trade disputes in the short run. As we discussed, there isn't enough global consensus on many of these issues, and there's also uncertainty regarding how WTO law, FTAs, the entire network of international trade agreements apply to the digital trade, to digital trade disputes. My sense is that the ambition for a digital trade framework should be more about setting up a more sophisticated, multi-layered framework for implementing digital trade rules. So therefore, using a network of institutions, and not just multilateral institutions, but also multi-stakeholder institutions, and perhaps even private bodies, especially if you think of private standard setting organizations and their pivotal role in the digital space. I think it would be these network of institutions coming together, listening to each other, liaising with each other, and still working within their specific domains of expertise. I think this would move towards what David was calling the interoperability amongst different regulators and different regulatory models. In terms of rules, because one component of your question was in terms of the kind of rules that can inform such a governance framework, I think it should ideally be a combination of some of the fundamental principles of international trade law, because they are pivotal again to a global trade framework, principles of non-discrimination, transparency, due process. But there would also be soft law norms or some kinds of codes, best practices that emerge in many of these areas that can be coupled with trade rules. So ultimately, the framework is much more multi-layered and complex. And I think this is a better option than binding legal obligation in international treaties, whether they are trade treaties or other cybersecurity treaties or other conventions, cybercrime conventions, because they are much harder to negotiate. And the outcome, therefore, is either they become very inflexible in nature or they are just too weak to be effective. And the challenge is perhaps in this kind of a framework to generate that kind of trust and cooperation between these different policy networks, and then to get that right balance between ensuring transparency and accountability, but also making sure that the policies and that come out of this regime are still effective and can have some effect in the real world. Thank you.
Thank you, Neha. Let me turn to David for that same question. So how do you see international governance working in this area?
Yeah, so I think it's a complicated picture and not a kind of one tool fits all. And maybe hearkening a little back to Neha's points before, I would kind of distinguish two types of rules. One is the more traditional trade agreement thou shall not rules, of not treating goods or services from your own national origin, you know, more favorably than you do of a foreign provider, MFN principles, transparency principles, market access principles. And there are others too, you know, in the world of TBT and least trade restrictive regulation. And I think that's an area where, yes, we're talking about new issues, but it's really new subject matter. The issues are actually quite old and well developed. And there's no reason that longstanding rules shouldn't be applied in a digital context. And indeed, we've already seen that, maybe not in some of the super hot button issues that we're talking about today, but actually one real hot button issue we forget sometimes, a very early, or not early, but you know, a bunch of years ago, a WTO case actually dealt with censorship issues and the distribution of audio visual materials in China, which the US litigated, and the US won at the WTO, not challenging the censorship regime per se, but the way that China was implementing that censorship regime in a way that wasn't least trade restrictive, that ultimately was restricting kind of who could provide distribution services in China, right? So those are kind of age-old WTO concepts applied in a new form. or the dispute over the information technology agreement, looking at all kinds of new technologies, applying old principles, and again, picking up something Neha said before, that this critical notion of technology neutrality. The principles apply. We don't care necessarily whether the particular technologies have changed in how a service or a product is being delivered. And that I would say, and I'm not speaking with my hat as a former WTO lawyer looking for cases, but I think litigation or really disputes can play a role in that in resolving issues between countries. I think the second set of rules, which is really more the getting into newer issues around what should affirmative obligations and norms be around different digital regulations about how should a privacy be approached or other new issues, which as some have noted, have already started to come into different trade agreements. I wouldn't rule out that dispute settlement can play a role in that, but I think those are areas that are trickier and more being developed. But to me, like the critical place that we are now in the global conversation in this period of kind of just an explosion of all different kinds of regulation is at a minimum, the common norms that we expect for any kind of trade regulation that have ultimately reap the benefits of trade when they're complemented with the right domestic policies, we should be doing the same thing in the trade space.
Thanks, David. Let me turn now to another big picture question. And I'm gonna try to incorporate something that an audience question into this. I'm not sure they exactly fit together, but I'll try it anyway. So my question is, what is the ideal structure for international agreements in this area? Should they be almost global at the WTO? Should they be regional, bilateral, plurilateral, coalitions of the willing? What structure is best and what is best and what's most likely to emerge in practice? And so let me then tie in this question that we got from the audience. So this goes back to interoperability, but he says, Felipe, I think on Facebook, says on interoperability and trade agreements, how can we leverage the ongoing WTO-based JSI on domestic regulations? Although there are no specific disciplines dealing with interoperability, there's ample room to innovate and advance the agenda under the new schedules. What do you think? So that's two questions that are only marginally related, and feel free to dive in on either of those. Let me turn first to Henry on this question what's the international structure that's most likely to emerge and what's best here?
Sure. Thank you, Simon. I think the most ideal structure would be a sort of a global deal. And I think the most ideal candidate would be at the WTO, because the WTO has a long history of regulating all these global trade and trade-related issues. And it, to be frank, has a very good record in this, much a better record than the other international organizations. But this most ideal situation has not really happened, even though the WTO has been discussing the issue for more than 20 years, as I mentioned earlier, since 1998. So in its place, if you look at the reality on the ground, we have all these regional deals like the CPTPP, like the USMCA, like the RCEP, and all these bilateral agreements, especially those concluded by the US. So the US has been including digital trade provisions in almost all its FTAs that has signed since the early 2000s. So that is the current situation that we have now. And also in the WTO, as you mentioned earlier, Simon, we have this so-called JSI Joint Statement Initiative, which started from the WTO subconference in Buenos Aires 3 years ago. And all these joint statement initiatives are what we call a plurilateral deals in the WTO, which means that not all WTO members would join the negotiation. Only some WTO members would join the negotiation. So it's basically a coalition of a willing, as you mentioned. And currently, there are, I think, about 90 WTO members which are in the GSIE commerce negotiation. And all these GSI, as far as I understand, are separate from each other, so that your participation in the e-commerce GSI would not prejudice your positions, for example, in the domestic regulation GSI. But I think we can still see some continuity in the submissions by the countries when it comes to you know, all these different GSI initiatives. So, for example, the US has been very concerned with the transparency, so it has tabled many transparency proposals, which I think are reflected in both the domestic regulation and also the e-commerce submissions. So there would be some kind of crossover, I think, between GSIs, but at the end of the day, if this GSI gets concluded, I think your obligation is still subject to whatever the specific obligations in the GSI that you are participating. And unless they are all brought over and multilateralized in the WTO in some way, I don't think you can really cross over the obligations from one to the other. That would be a long way. I think the most realistic thing to happen now would be for them to agree to some sort of deal in each of these GSI first, and they each operate in like a separate parallel universe, you know, so that they do not really interact with each other. Thank you.
Thanks, Henry. Neha, do you want to weigh in on this? What's the best structure for these agreements, and what's most likely to emerge?
Well, the optimist in me wants to agree with Henry that it would be ideal to have a WTO, a multilateral framework under the WTO, and if not a multilateral, at least a high quality plurilateral agreement which covers many of these substantive issues. I think the reality, and Henry already spoke about this, is that there might be more regional and bilateral initiatives that become prevalent, at least in the short run. And I think while there is possibility of top-down and bottom-up policy movement in this space, the likelihood is more about bottom-up policy movement. So, for instance, where regional and bilateral initiatives are successful, they are likely to be replicated elsewhere, probably at a broader regional level or maybe at a global level. And maybe this would help in some level of interoperability across regimes, depending on how they develop. And let me just, I mean, if you think of the developments, they're quite interesting. If you look at the CPTPP and the RCEP, despite coming from very different or reflecting different policy priorities, the architecture of both the electronic commerce chapters are quite similar. The provisions, the substantive provisions are different, but the architecture is quite similar, which kind of indicates that all countries are invested in this economic aspect of digital trade, even those countries which are not evidently supporters of free trade. So I think these kinds of development at regional and bilateral level are going to be very crucial. Another aspect that I think is relevant is regional coalitions, especially for developing countries who don't have that kind of voice in mega regional discussions or in negotiations at the GSI. I think regional coalition gives them a better voice. And in some of the recent work that I have been doing, where I have been examining recent FTA e-commerce chapters and FTAs, there is actually very little that deals with the digital development dimension of that affects developing countries, even basic issues like regulatory assistance and technical capacity building. So I think some of these regional coalitions would be an important counterweight if and where they develop successfully, whether it's in Africa or Southeast Asia or in South America. So I think, yeah, it's a more of a complex framework, definitely in the short run, in my view.
Thanks, Neha. Okay, for my next question, I want to turn to something that I think Henry already touched on, but I want to put the question out there and get David's take on it, and Henry can respond if you want, but you know, maybe he said everything he has to say and he doesn't have to, but if he can respond if you want. So my question is, as Henry, you know, suggested to us, there are countries, there are different countries out there. There's China, the US, and the EU, whether it's country or not, have very different domestic policies and cultural norms. And you know, what I wonder is, do the differences between these three and the rest of the world as well, there are differences among all of the countries out there, does that make the task of coming to meaningful international agreements here just too daunting? I mean, is it really possible to get international consensus and agreement on many of the issues when you have, you know, so many countries with just different cultural norms and domestic politics? David, what's your take on that?
So as a trade policy warrior, my answer has to be yes to that question, Simon. Look, the honest answer is there are some things and differences that can be bridged and some that aren't. And I think that really speaks to the issues that Neha and Henry were just talking about in terms of different approaches to governance. So there are going to be certain issues where one can reach agreement at a global level, and some of the different kind of approaches that Henry alluded to can be bridged, and there are going to be others that can't be, and you know, hence bilateral agreements and regional agreements, and by the way, I'd note a lot of these are happening sometimes not with the U.S. at the table, of course, RCEP and some initiatives like that. But also sort of what I would call almost more digital forward agreements and initiatives, like the agreements that Singapore has been pursuing, the digital economy partnership agreements in the region, which I think is a really interesting model, which to your point on there are differences in domestic regulatory approaches, looking at softer norms and dialogues before you take that step of writing in firm binding commitments, and encouraging regulator to regulator dialogue, encouraging, you know, as new regulations on AI or other issues are developed, making sure that the trade policymakers are at the table, so they're considering the questions of interoperability and how this affects cross-border commerce. But maybe it's not quite ripe for, you know, binding rules that are subject to dispute settlement, and maybe it's not ripe for kind of multilateral consensus. So I think it really is a question of we need a bunch of different tools here, and there are some issues we're going to bridge and some issues that we're not.
Let Henry respond if he wants, but let me turn to a question I see coming from the audience that relates to this. And you know, Henry, you can respond to this, or respond to David, or other people can weigh in here. So the question is there a danger that the United States is not engaging enough at the WTO or in regional trade agreements to write new rules on digital trade that protect free commerce, and that in a few years a lot of the rules set by China and the EU might become the global norm? So, I mean, let me turn first to Henry on either a response to David or that question, and then I'll turn to the others if they have thoughts on US engagement here.
Okay, so let me start with the question from the audience, Simon. I'm not too worried about the US, losing out in this competition of setting the rules, because I think the US has been quite active in WTO negotiations, and I personally think that is where the real rules are being made. And coming back to the WTO, I don't think the WTO is ever about forcing everyone to the same standard, but my review of the WTO is, as you mentioned earlier, Simon, that is more about ensuring interoperability between different regimes. So you see all these different regimes, these different models that I mentioned earlier, but as I also argue that we start to see some convergence. So in the WTO, I think even though some people are quite pessimistic about the prospects for the GSIE commerce negotiation, but I'm more optimistic because we already have examples of success in the WTO. If you look at, for example, the trade facilitation agreement. When the first started, it was quite divisive. I mean, many developing countries were really unhappy to be dragged along to negotiate on trade facilitation. But in the end, we had an agreement. Why? Because the TFA took the approach of having a kind of a tiered obligations depending on the development levels or willingness of individual members. And this is something that we could use for the GSI e-commerce negotiation. Or what we could do is we could adopt something similar to the DIPA, as David mentioned earlier, you know, a kind of modular approach so that you have a different modules and countries can pick and choose as which individual module that they would accept. But I said we already start to see the lowest common denominator. If you look at all these FTAs concluded by the US, by China, and by the EU, I think the consensus now is that the minimum standard will have to include some fundamental agreement to free flow of data across border and also prohibition on data localization requirements. And then as to how much security exception or privacy exception that you would put there, that is subject to haggling. But I think if we agree to this fundamental obligation of a free flow of data and prohibition on data localization requirements, then we are in a pretty good shape already. Thank you.
Thanks, Henry. Let me just quickly see if Dave, I think David, you might be most in tune with what the US negotiators are thinking right now. What would you say to the question of whether the US is engaging enough on this issue?
Look, I think we're early in a new administration, and you know, let the U.S. government, USTR, speak for itself. I think in general, this has been a real area of priority for the U.S. government, both across the executive branch and in Congress. And you know, I think what's really interesting about these conversations from 10 years ago is it's not just a handful of really, internet companies, right? All companies are digital companies today, and you correspondingly have seen just kind of a wide level of interest on these issues across various U.S. stakeholder communities and the U.S. business community. So, I'm pretty confident that the U.S. will continue to be at the table. Obviously, there will be a lot of, or there is. A lot of discussion and debate about, what the U.S. should be negotiating and what agreements are ripe or not. I would just note that, a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. and the EU at the, or I guess last week at the U.S.-EU summit announced this Transatlantic Trade and Technology Council. That's very far from a trade agreement or something like that. But it just sort of shows, I think, the hunger and interest of engaging on these issues and across countries and the need for developing norms in this space.
Thanks, David. Okay, so we're getting close to the end of the time. So I'm going to skip ahead a question. That's just a note to the panelists. So this is a question for Neha, and others can weigh in if they want. So sometimes these agreements are referred to as digital trade or e-commerce agreements, but it seems to me that in terms of the substance, that they're often broader than that. They might be about data flows or digital governance generally. So I guess my questions are, is trade agreement a misleading term here? Should this even be part of the trade regime? I mean, we've seen examples where sometimes the digital rules are a chapter in a trade agreement. Sometimes they're just a separate agreement on their own. For example, the US-Japan digital agreement. How should we do this? Are trade folks qualified to handle this? Should this really be put off somewhere else? And we've seen this kind of debate already with intellectual property and labor and the environment. And so I guess the broad question is, does digital trade, do digital governance issues belong in the trade regime, or would it be better if there was sort of a separate regime outside of the trade context?
Sorry. Thank you, Simon. So my view is that a lot of issues that are covered in the trade agreements, in these digital trade agreements or the e-commerce chapters of some of these FTAs, they deal more with regulatory barriers, non-tariff barriers, and that kind of is discomforting in some sense because trade agreements have traditionally been about tariff barriers, not regulatory barriers. A lot of focus, if you think of the GATT, a lot of focus was on regulatory barriers. So I don't necessarily think it's out of context within a trade agreement. And similarly, in terms of expertise, surely, I mean, trade folks are not qualified in all domains of digital regulation. They, as I said before, they should not be a standard setting body. But this is a, you know, this is a complex regulatory framework, and the WTO or other trade organizations have their role in this complex framework to deal with a certain dimension of digital regulation. I mean, at the end of the day, is there an acknowledgement within the trade policy circles that these issues are cross-cutting? Certainly, there is definitely an acknowledgement, but we've not got to that stage yet where different institutions are coordinating with each other. So I recently read an OECD paper, which where the researchers found that there are 52 instruments in 24 different fora on digital trade, which just shows the number of stakeholders in this area. So it's definitely a very complex framework, and all the solutions, not all the problems arise out of trade agreements, and not all the solutions can be also prescribed within trade agreements. And I also don't think it's a wise idea to treat this as a separate domain of regulation, even within the trade context, because if you think of the economy at large, we live in a digital economy. Even very traditional processes such as manufacturing or logistics are highly data driven. They are dependent on digital trade. So there's no escaping from this deep integration of the digital with the rest of the economy. And I think it would be unwise to kind of leave this out completely from trade regulation. It would be going in the wrong direction. So I don't think it's necessarily out of context, but I do agree that we should tread with caution and be very clear about what a trade agreement can do and can't do, and know where trade agreements should incorporate international standards by reference, or where they should just play a proactive part in a larger policy network. Definitely, that caution is very necessary.
Thank you, Neha. This might be the last question. I see we're coming close to the time, and this one's going to get a little bit into the weeds. So for anyone still paying attention out there, I'll start with Henry. Anyone else can weigh in if they want. So, you know, my question, this is something I wrote a short paper about, to some aspect of this. What is the core of these agreements? Is it about nationality-based non-discrimination? And is that what the provisions entitled non-discrimination are about? Is that what the provisions on free flow of data are about? Do we need both of these provisions? I mean, I guess the question is, do we have the principles worked out when, you know, it's just not clear to me exactly what the core of this is. And Henry, do you have thoughts on this? Well, you know, is non-discrimination defined properly in these agreements? Is that the core principle? Somewhere in there are some questions that you might want to answer, and I'll turn to you.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. Well, non-discrimination is a favorite for trade lawyers, so I can see why you raised that. And you could indeed argue that these agreements are really about non-discrimination, but different types. For example, data flow by definition, the search restrictions affect only foreign websites, so you can see that it's MFN. And the data localization discriminate against the foreign firms in favor of the local firms. So you can see that it's national treatment obligation. But if you look at all these agreements keeps popping up, you can see that they actually go beyond the narrow non-discrimination obligations, because these agreements also include provisions on, for example, e-commerce trade facilitation or enabling e-commerce type of provisions. They also include provisions regulating the behavior of firms like personal information protection, online consumer protection, and solicited messages, and so on. And now, if you look at the GSI negotiations, you can see that more provisions are being inserted into such agreements. For example, the GSI proposals include provisions on access to and use of internet for e-commerce, telecom equipment provisions, which are called the Huawei provision because it was proposed by China. So I would say that it started with non-discrimination, but that is the bare minimum. And we are going to see all sorts of provisions in this negotiation. Thanks.
Very much, Henry. I think we're at 10 o'clock now, and I think I have to close this out. Thank you very much to the panelists for joining me at this late or early hour, depending where you are. Thank you to the attendees for watching. I tried to work in the questions I could get to. If I didn't get to yours, I'm sorry. The recording will be available on Cato's website shortly. And thank you very much, and have a good rest of the evening or a good rest of your day.